All right, 9 days format here at JM and the AM. You know what that means. It means Ribera Wine is going to dominate our spoken word format with some of his amazing and interesting lectures. This is actually a new lecture series, or I should say relatively new lecture series, that he gave in Jerusalem about Europe and the Jews. And there's a tremendous amount of history here that will help us relate to what is going on now during this era, that's for sure. And therefore, I present to you Rabbi Beryl Wine, Europe and the Jews. This specific lecture is entitled Pagan Europe and Its Impact on the Jews. Information about all of Rabbi Wine's lectures, 1-800-499-WEIN. You can also go to the web at rabbiwine.com, rabbiwein.com, rabbiwein.com. Pagan Europe and Its Impact on the Jews, Rabbi Beryl Wine. This is JM in the AM.
Good evening, everyone. Shavua Tov. Thank you all for coming on this beautiful night in Jerusalem. This lecture series, Europe and the Jews, will attempt to give us a chronological and ideological view of Jewish life in Europe over two millennia, and also the attitude of the Europeans towards Jews and the events that occurred both in Europe and actually in the Jewish community. But you have to realize that a certain amount of European history is necessary because Jews don't live in a vacuum and things don't happen to us only to us. It's all part of a heavenly pattern that governs all types of human events. So this lecture tonight is somewhat of an introduction to explain where we're going, and also to talk about the earliest history, so to speak, of Europe and of its impact upon Jews, most of which was very negligible at the beginning. But beginning with the arrival of the Greeks and the Romans, became very, very influential and part of the Jewish and the European story. Europe is defined from the Mediterranean to the Baltic and from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains. As continents go, it's a small continent in space, but perhaps it, in the history, so far, it's been the most important continent in terms of human civilization, both for good and for better. And the strength of Europe, what is that for? Until really the last century, we could say, it was the dominant power in the world. And all of the world was influenced by Europe and by how Europe behaved towards everyone else. Now, in ancient times, let's say in the beginning of the time, in Bais Rishon, First Temple times, so then Europe was the dark continent. That's what they called Africa in the 19th century. Meaning we knew it existed, but no one knew who lived there. And no one really cared who lived there. And it was unexplored. So who did live there? And how did they get there? So that's one of the continuing mysteries of history and of sociology. Where do all these people come from? The biblical narrative is that civilization began, and that's really the narrative that most historians also accept, that civilization began in the Fertile Crescent, began in what is today Iraq, in the Middle East. We have in the Chumash the story of the Tower of Babel, and it says, Mishom nafotsu al pnei kol haaretz. And then people scattered, since they didn't speak the same language, they didn't have the same culture, so they moved. Now the nature of people is to move. People are transients. I saw that when I was now in the United States, the statistic is that Americans will move at least three or four times in their lifetime, because we are basically nomads. That somehow is within our DNA. So that's why we like to take cruises to China, and we like to see the whole world, because of the fact that we are wanderers. And usually the more secure and the more wealthy the person is, the more the person wants to leave home. It's almost a psychological thing. So people scattered all over the world. Not only that, there were different races. People looked differently. The Asiatic people, the Negroid people, the Caucasian people. People look differently, and that's part of the process of humanity, even though we don't quite understand what caused that, whether it was environment, genetics, whatever it is, but that's what it is. So basically, Europe, in its infancy as we know it, was composed of Caucasians, of white people, who were hunters and who were pagans. Now, the idea of paganism, why intelligent people should believe in all sorts of gods, but paganism exists today in the world, and to a great extent, for the first few thousand years of civilization, almost everybody was a pagan. But there were different forms of paganism. You know, Nusach Ashkenaz, Nusach Svar. When it comes to belief, there is never one total belief. People don't respond that way. People adjust faith to their own needs and ideas. And paganism existed in the Middle East. And the time we see Avraham Avinu at the time of Nimrod rebels against paganism, we see that the entire Torah, so to speak, the basic rule of the Torah is don't be a pagan. The Rambam says in his famous explanation of mitzvot, of the commandments of the Torah, he said all of the commandments of the Torah come to deny paganism. And therefore, when you have certain specific commandments that seem to us not to be very logical. For instance, he discusses the eating of milk and meat together. So there was a time when people thought that was a health matter, but that's not true. So then what's wrong with having a glass of milk with a steak? And Rambam says that what's wrong with it is that that was a pagan practice. And the pagan practice was to take a meat animal, usually the mother, and cook it in the milk, or to take rather the calf, and cook it in the milk of the mother. And that was seen as, so to speak, a spiritual experience and not merely a culinary experience. And therefore the Rambam says, so the Torah came and said, Lo sevashil gedi b'chalev imo, you shall not cook the calf in its mother's milk. That's because of paganism. It's been expanded in our time by through the Rabbonin and the Gemara. We learn it became a the general separation of dairy and meat dishes, etc., etc. But the origin is paganism, the defeat of paganism. And the Torah has many, many statements to that effect. Lo sifnu el elilim, don't go to the idols. Don't pray to the dead. Don't have superstitions. Don't believe in witchcraft. Because those are all pagan ideas. Very strong pagan ideas. And they're so strong that, without being too controversial here on the first lecture, I would still say that some of it has seeped into current day Jewish society. And that's not really what the Torah intended for us. So there were different paganisms. Every group of people, the people divided themselves somehow into tribes, because tribal affiliation is also a human quality, and it exists until today. Europe, even today, is a collection of tribes, many of whom don't like each other and haven't liked each other for thousands of years. Balkan Wars that existed in the 1990s were basically tribal wars. The Croats, the Slovenes, the Serbs, the Montenegrins, those who lived in Kosovo, those are all old tribes that never got along with each other. Why don't tribes get along with each other? Because of territory, because human beings are territorial. Just ask your vada by it. Human beings also are greedy. They don't appreciate what they have. They want what the other person has. And therefore, the drive is always to acquire from others what they feel they're lacking. And human beings are violent, as we are well aware of. And if you give them a cause, and the cause can be religion, the cause can be nationalism, the cause can be revenge, any cause is sufficient to evoke a violent streak in people. So Europe is full of tribes. We'll see Julius Caesar in his famous works on his wars. So he describes the Gauls and the Huns, the Visigoths, all of the tribes that he had to deal with and conquer and bring them under Roman rule. But Europe is full of separate tribes. Just as in the Middle East, it is all separate tribes. Those are not kingdoms. Those are not countries as we think of a country or a nation state today. So it says, Avimelech was the king of the Philistines. The Philistines are a tribe. And the Canaanites were a tribe. And the Amorites were a tribe. And the Jewish people in their search for diversity, so we had 12 tribes. And this tribal affinity created in the pagan world different pagan gods. So you have conflicting mythologies. Because the story of the gods, human beings had to know that in order somehow to relate to nature. And nature is unpredictable. It's often dangerous. I mean, we're not talking about a world that had lighting or running water, medicine. None of that existed. And you have wild animals running all over. And therefore, it became necessary to construct this mythology. So I'll give you an example of European mythology that exists until today. Tomorrow is what day? By us, it's Yom Rishon. But by everybody else, it's Sunday. Sunday is the day of the sun god. Monday is the day of the moon god. Wednesday, because there was the chief god in the Norse, in the Scandinavian mythologies, was someone by the name of Woden. So it was Woden's day. And Thursday is Thor's day. Saturday is Saturn's day. So that has become part of our culture. We don't even think twice. The rabbis were always careful, to warn us against secular dating. I mean dates, not dates. They warned us against that too, but it was of little avail. Because of the fact that it's not only that 2015 is not a Jewish date at all, and in fact it is a Christian date that's been accepted in society, but even to say Wednesday or even the days in a month. January is the god Janus, and March is Mars. And then the Roman emperors got involved, so July became Julius Caesar made July, Augustus Caesar made August, September was the seventh month that now became the ninth month, because Julius Caesar and Augustus inserted their months in the calendar. October is the 8th month, December is the 10th month. So we don't give that any thought whatsoever, because we are so accustomed that that way it is. I mean, that's can't do business without knowing when September is or when Thursday is. But traditional Jews always said Thursday is Yom Chamishi, and when the month is Mar Cheshvan, and the year is 5776, according to our count, when the count began. That's a different lecture from which you are not paying. So the pagans had conflicting ideologies, conflicting religions. The gods of Troy and the gods of Greece. So whenever there was a war, the mind imagined, the pagan mind imagined that the gods were fighting. And what paganism did is it took the gods and made them humans. And not only made them humans, it made them bad humans. Robbers, murderers, womanizers. The gods are the worst people you can imagine. Capricious. Well, if the gods are like that, so then the people also are like that. If that's our concept of the gods, then it's going to be very difficult to have a different concept. And that's why Avraham Avinu is such a revolutionary, because he envisions God not in the terms that the pagan world envisioned gods. He'll say to God, Ashofet kol ha'aretz lo ya'aseh mishpat. The judge of the world should not do justice. Well, no pagan would expect their gods to do justice, whatever their definition of justice was, because that was not what the gods were. The gods were selfish, the gods were violent, the gods cheated on each other. And so therefore that is how the pagan civilization developed. Now there were exceptions. There was an exception in Egypt where there was a flash of monotheism by Akhenaten, one of the Egyptian pharaohs. Basically, we will see an evolution in paganism. They, so to speak, have to outgrow the basic ideas of paganism, but they keep the form of paganism. And that's what Europe was in pre-Christian times. That's what it was 2,000 years ago. But it was a wild place. And again, the countries are tribal. The Huns came from Germany. The Franks came from France. That's where these countries got their name. The Angles got their name. Were England. The Scots were from Scotland. The Celtics were a soccer team. They were all different tribes. And different tribes had different languages. And they had different gods. Now, we don't know, for instance, if you've ever been in England and they took you to Stonehenge, you got these enormous monuments. What are they? Who made them? For what purpose? So that's, you can get a PhD thesis if you come up with an answer. No one knows. But for instance, in the Torah, it says, Lo sochim lecha matzeva asher sonei Hashem alakecha. Do not establish any of these monuments, great stone structures, because God, that's paganism. The Gemara itself asked the question, why did Yaakov Avinu establish a monument? Right? Yaakov made his Stonehenge, so to speak. How was he allowed to do that? So the Gemara answers, which is a difficult answer, subject to many, many interpretations, but I think the question remains stronger than any of the answers, is that what was forbidden to the children was permissible to the fathers. Some say, I saw Rav Hirsch and others say, that so to speak, Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov are the beginnings of monotheism. They're the beginnings of the development of Judaism. They're the beginnings of Judaic thought. And therefore, what was permitted to them would not be permitted to the Jewish people after they accepted the Torah, after they have Moses as their instructor, after, so to speak, the entire idea of Judaism and monotheism is full-blown already. But in any event, it's obvious what the Torah tells us. We are not allowed to make a Stonehenge. But all over Europe, we have all of these artifacts of pagan Europe. And this was a connection, so to speak, with the paganism that existed in the Middle East. But it seems that the paganism in the Middle East was of a higher form, had more intellect involved in it. And that's why we'll see that Greece and Rome, even though they were pagan, and nevertheless were developed civilizations, whereas the other pagan civilizations remained primitive almost to the end. They did not advance in any of these things because their concepts were different. They didn't blend together with the ideas of the paganism that existed in the Middle East. Now, we have references in Tanakh, say a commercial in Treyosar, in the Book of the 12 Prophets, for which there is a great book explaining everything that Rabbi Amstel will be glad to sell you. But there it says, it mentions Tzorfat, Sfarad. Now in modern day Hebrew, Tzorfat is France and Sfarad is Spain. Did the Novi, we're talking about a Novi before the destruction, the first temple times, did they know of France? Did they know of Spain? Or is it those were names of local places that Jews later gave to countries that they came from? There are two opinions for a change. There are different opinions as to how that worked. Now, for instance, we have the word Tarshish. Yonah wants to go to Tarshish. Now, where's Tarshish? So some say Tarshish is where Casablanca is today. In other words, the end of the Mediterranean, the westernmost space of the Mediterranean. Most people were afraid to cross the Straits of Gibraltar because they believed that the world was flat and you would fall off the edge. And in the Gemara, it's called the Okeanos HaGadol, the Great Ocean. Now, in Tanakh, we have already the statement that the earth is round. Hayoshev al chug haaretz, God who sits over the circle of the earth. But people, first of all, people don't read the Tanakh. It's not in the curriculum. And secondly, people don't always believe the Tanakh. So they said, well, that's a metaphor. And it wasn't until the end of the 15th and the beginning of the 16th century when the Portuguese and Spanish sailors, Vasco da Gama and Columbus, etc., sailed across the Atlantic that it became apparent that the world was not flat and you weren't going to fall off the end. But where was Tarshish? So the simple explanation, the most logical explanation, is Tarshish is the Syrian port that exists today near Turkey in the Mediterranean. And then later the word Tarshish was taken by Jews that traveled, and they called it, you have that in the United States, New York, New England, New Haven. All of the English cities, the names of the English cities were transported to the United States by the English who settled there. So that's a common thing. And therefore we could say that Sfarad and Tzorfas referred to areas within the Mediterranean basin that were known as that in the time of the Novi. But later when the Jews traveled, and they settled in Spain, and they settled in France, so they called it Tzorfas and Sfarad. So you can take your pick there. So if, for instance, they really meant France or Spain, so then even at First Temple times, Jews were aware of Europe. And not only that, the Pasuk says that they did business, Kananim, that they were merchants to these places. They did trade, and the tribe of Zvulun was famous for the fact that its merchant ships traversed the entire Mediterranean. So then the Jews did trade somehow there. But we have no record of it. But we have a great legend. Legends are not history. But legends are things that people love. And usually there's a kernel of truth in every legend. The rest of it is made up. It's like a rabbi's sermon. There's a bit of truth, and then there's a lot of verbiage. For instance, I always use the example that there are legends about the Chafetz Chaim, and there are legends about Richard Nixon. And neither of them are true, but they certainly characterize the person. You don't say the same legend about Nixon that you say about the Chafetz Chaim. So there is some basis to legends. So I want to tell you a great legend. There was a Jewish community in Europe called Shum, Shin Vav Mem. That was the acronym for three little villages at the time that were governed by the Jews as one kehillah. The Shin was Shapiro, the Vav was Vermeise, the Mem was Magenza. Now those are all Jewish names that still exist today. You have people named Shapiro, Magenza, etc. Shapiro is the city of spires, and Vermeise is the city of worms, which in German was Worms, and Magenza was the city of Mainz. These three Jewish communities were destroyed in the First Crusade. Now, when bad things happen to us, you know, there's a career that you can have of writing books about why bad things happen to good people. In fact, there are people who have made it a career to write such books. Because how can it be that these three wonderful communities, Rashi studied in the yeshiva in Mainz, Rabbeinu Gershom Or HaGolo was established the yeshiva in Mainz, great communities. They were destroyed in the First Crusade, massacred. Why them? There were other Jewish communities that the Crusaders passed by. They didn't stop to kill. So that's always a question, right? On all tragedies, on all difficult situations. Why? Why this person? What happened here? And especially we are believers in Hashgacha Pratit, that things don't just happen at random, that somehow, somewhere, there is some reason for what happens. So even though for us it's not clear, the whole world is illogical, makes no sense, but that somehow in God's great plan, it fits. So why Shapiro, Vermeise, and Magenza? So there's a great legend that when Ezra HaSofer brought back the Jews to the land of Israel at the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, there were these three Jewish communities were already in existence, meaning that there were Jews in Europe, not only in Europe, on the Rhineland, on the Rhine River, in 400 before the Common Era, 350 before the Common Era. And these were communities. Now, Ezra was, like the Jewish agency, singularly unsuccessful in bringing about Aliyah. He tried to bring the Jews from Bovel. Out of maybe 600,000-700,000 Jews, he was only able to bring 42,000. And he didn't bring the cream of the crop. The Talmud teaches us, Asorah Yuchsin Olam Bovel, 10 stages of legitimacy came. So the Gemara says, Mamzerim, Shtukim, Avodim, all sorts of questionable people. They're the ones that came there to Israel because the Rabbanut has to be busy. But the Shena Eden, the fine, good Jews, they stayed in Bavel. They said, it's good here. Why should we go home? And the Gemara says, Lo Olo Ezra. Ezra did not come to Eretz Yisrael. Achosa Bavel Kasolis Nikia. Bavel was perfect. Meaning that if somebody said they could prove they came from Bavel, they never checked his legitimacy. Because everyone in Bavel was perfect. It was the Borough Park of its time. So Ezra, the legend is that Ezra sends, I don't know how he sent it. The Israeli post office wasn't any better then than now. But somehow he sends a message to the Jews in Shapiro, Vermeisa, and Mainz. And he says, come back to Yerushalayim with me. We're going to rebuild the second temple. We need people. We need bodies on the ground. Come. And they wrote him back and they said, listen, we're in great shape here. Everything here is good. Why should we bother? We're not coming. And the legend is that 1800 years later, the Crusaders took care of them because that was their attitude. Now that's a legend. And the only reason I bring up the legend is not for the obvious lesson of Aliyah, but the reason I bring up the legend is that according to the legend, the Jews were in Europe already before the Second Temple. How did they get there? Why were they there? That has never been explained. So probably this legend has to be chalked up to fantasy. But again, the fact that such a legend exists can somehow give us an idea that even in ancient times, Jews were aware of Europe, and Jews sought to live in Europe, and that Europe gave them opportunities that, so to speak, the Middle East did not, which will explain a lot of what we're going to talk about over the next few Saturday nights as well, God willing. So Europe is this pagan society, tribal to an extreme, and the Jews have some sort of relationship with it, though probably a very nebulous one, because the whole civilized Middle East has almost no relationship with Europe. To them, again, as I mentioned before, it is the dark continent. It's not something that's real. Now what happens is as follows. The Jews feel that there is a bigger world out there than the confines of the land of Israel. That was one of the results of the destruction of the First Temple. In the time of the First Temple, Jews were farmers. The whole country was based on agriculture. We see it in the Chumash and in the Tanakh. All of the blessings are agricultural blessings. All of the ideas and the myriad halachas which exist are all agricultural. In our time, agriculture is very important, but it's not the basis of the Israeli economy. It's not the basis of many economies. It's a necessary economy because if you don't have what to eat, you don't have what to eat. If you don't have food, then you can't work your computer. But it does not play the role in terms of manpower and in terms of emphasis that it once did. The United States also was a rural agricultural country until the late 1800s, even the beginning of the 1900s, until it became urbanized. So Europe is hunters. It's not agriculture. It's a different economy, different way of dealing with things. And all of the sociologists say that in the stages of civilization, eventually the hunters became farmers. And eventually the farmers became city dwellers. And eventually the city dwellers bought farmland to live in the suburbs. but that this progression took place. So the Jews were in agriculture. If they're in agriculture, then you're basically bound to the land that you have. You can't be a farmer and live, let's say, near Beersheba and expect that you're going to somehow do business. This before refrigeration, before shipping, before anything. You're not going to sell, flowers in Paris the next day. So because of that, Jews were localized. They didn't think in universal international terms. Comes the Churban, Bayis Rishon, the destruction of the first temple. It comes as a shock, an enormous national shock. How could God destroy his own house? The house where miracles occurred daily. God's name is on the house. How could he destroy that? And that, in essence, was the Jewish safety belt during First Temple times. They felt that no matter what crimes they committed, no matter how evil they behaved, no matter how warped their social conscience was, God would let it pass because he couldn't afford the desecration of his name, so to speak, that the destruction of the temple and the sending of the Jewish people into exile would occasion. Now the prophets warned. The prophet said, to a great extent, don't count on God. God is going to be God without the temple. And God is going to be God without you here in the country. You have to count on yourselves. Rachatzu, Hizaku, cleanse yourselves. And Jewish people ignored it, because they were confident that God would not allow it to happen. Even when the prophet Yirmiyahu tells them in advance all the details as to what's going to happen, how Bovel is going to come, the Nebuchadnezzar will come and destroy them, they put him in jail because they don't want to hear what he has to say, and rather they want to listen to the false prophets who say everything is going to be splendid, everything's going to be wonderful. Don't worry, God won't do it. Now, just to digress, but there's a certain failing that we see. People say God will help, God won't let it happen. And many times that just becomes an excuse. It becomes a cop-out for our not having to do anything. And then if you say that that's the case, so then you're accused of being at best a heretic or a non-believer. So I remember I once had an experience that it was before Pesach. That was when I had my yeshiva in Muncie. And the yeshivas are always behind in money. And by Pesach, I was determined somehow to pay up all of the debts, certainly to the salaries of the rabbeim, etc. And it was a very hard time for me. And I went to see a Jew who I did a great favor for. And he was a very wealthy man. And I figured that he would have compassion on me. Every rabbi has to have a little naivete. So I went to see him, and I told him my plight. I said, I need X amount of dollars, and I need it by Pesach, and help me. So he said, no problem, Rabbi. Took out his checkbook, and he wrote out a check and gave me the check. So my policy in life is that if somebody gives me a check, I never look at it in front of the person who gave it to me. But here, my peripheral vision showed me that he forgot a zero. And evidently, my disappointment registered on my face. So he said to me, Rabbi Wein, don't worry, God will help. And I said to him, that's my speech, not yours. I tell people God will help. You write checks, I tell people God will help. So we have a tendency, God will help. By the way, he took back the check and he added the zero. But that's our nature, right? So, God certainly will help us, right? But he can't help us if we don't have an army. He can't help us if we don't have an economy. He can't help us if we don't do what we're supposed to do. And the Chazon Ish wrote regarding learning Torah, he said, only when a person exhausts all of his mental and physical faculties in learning Torah does heaven come to help. But until then, you want to know how to learn? Go learn. Don't daven to God. Go learn. So the Jews felt that they were in good shape because God was going to help. God did not help them. Sent them into exile. Now, going into exile changed their world view. They saw an outside world. They no longer were farmers. Because when you came to Bavel, how could you be a farmer? You didn't have any land. So Jews, because of the exile, became what they became. Traders, merchants, a primitive form of banking, service industry people, tradesmen. And therefore, the whole situation changed. And because of that, therefore, they looked at the world differently. And if they were aware that there were, let's say, markets in Europe, so then Europe was a place. And we know that there's a certain adventurous spirit amongst all of those that go down to the sea in ships. And the Jews were merchants in ships, sailors, tribe of Zvulun, and later the tribes in Ethiopia until they settled. They were all shipmasters, and that creates an industry by itself because you have to supply the ships. And therefore, it is very possible that Jews reached Europe. Sometimes you reach it by intent, and sometimes the boat gets shipwrecked offshore. And you discover that somehow there's a place there. But the influence of Europe on the Jews in Second Temple times, when Ezra existed, was minimal. Apparently they knew it was there, because already the Greeks existed in the time of Ezra. Alexander the Great would come to the land of Israel and meet Shimon HaTzadik, the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, the men of the Great Assembly. So they knew Europe was there, and they had intercourse with Europe. They dealt with Europe. But that was Europe on the Mediterranean. You have to remember, Greece and Rome are basically Mediterranean countries, much more than they are European countries. Europe, the great vast continent, still remained the dark continent to the Jews. They didn't have any intercourse with them, didn't do business with them, and those kind of, they were not, the difference in civilization between Europe and the Middle East was enormous. A little like the third world countries that existed after the Second World War, being compared to the economies of the United States or of other great countries. They were primitive. And therefore, a primitive country is there to be exploited. It's not there to be raised to any level. That was the problem that existed throughout the world, and to a certain extent exists even today. So the Jews had no illusions about Europe. They didn't see themselves as Europeans. And the paganism, the primitive paganism of the European tribes, certainly was a great turnoff. Now, Jews worshipped gods. Jews were influenced by paganism. But their paganism was sophisticated. And we'll talk about in the next lecture about Greece and Rome. That's a different type of paganism. That's already an intellectual paganism, if you will, which exists today in the world. Today it's a secular paganism, and it's an intellectual of secularism, which has made inroads, deep inroads into the Jewish people. But the paganism of Woden or Thor, that didn't register with them at all. That never was a problem to them. And even when the Jews came to those countries, and the pagans still existed, since Christianity didn't convert everybody at one time. The Jews never felt that that somehow was something that they would be interested in. Whereas when the Greeks and the Romans came, the Jews were very interested in the Greek gods. And they're very interested in the Roman gods, because that represented an intellectual paganism, and Jews always respond to things that at least are labeled intellectual, and therefore they were able to make such inroads. So to sum up, the situation was that Jews in First Temple times probably had some knowledge of the existence of Europe. Part of the reason is because there was a great traffic in slaves in the ancient world, and could very well be that slaves were taken from Europe and brought to the Middle East, therefore there would be some knowledge of the fact that this continent existed and had people in it, but the Jews really had very, very little to do with it. Europe, on the other hand, will have to develop, and that's the story of the Greeks and the Romans, and then later of Christianity, in creating this monolithic, enormously influential continent that ruled the world for almost two millennia. And then the Jews would really have to have something to do with it. And the Jews would live in that continent, continue to live there today, precarious as it is. And the history of that continent with the Jews is not a pleasant one. There's a book called Europe and the Jews, written by a Catholic priest, Malcolm Xavier Hay, H-A-Y. It's an outstanding little book that details of the anti-Semitism of Europe from the beginning of its existence until the Holocaust. I imagine we could add another chapter now about the anti-Semitism of Europe after the Holocaust and the uncertain state of Jews who still live in Europe but who live there in a state of fear. There was an article in the Atlantic Monthly right after the Charlie Hebdo French massacre in Paris, written by an American Jew who lived in Israel, I think, for a year, and who claims at the beginning of the article that he's an avowed leftist and that he disapproves of the policies of the Israeli government. So that's in order to clear the decks so that people will read the next part. But the next part is that Europe is gone as far as the Jews are concerned, and that to think differently is really whistling past the graveyard. You're really fooling yourself. So that if you read all of this, you read the article, you read Hay's book, you get a feeling of the fact that somehow the Jews who lived in Europe for 2,000 years and who were such a part of European civilization and never were part of Europe, never were accepted in Europe, never had the degree of confidence or security about themselves in Europe that they have had in other places in the world, that American Jewry had for a while. That never existed in Europe, no matter what. And therefore, the idea of this lecture series is to point out how in each and every different period of European history, beginning next week with the Greeks and the Romans, how the ideas, the actions, the behavior, the worldview affected the Jews, and how the Jews reacted to it, and what finally happened because of it. Sometimes good things happened, but most of the time it ended up to be very tragic and sad. It ended up to be very dysfunctional. And that this long story of Europe and the Jews is really one long tragic Greek play in which the good guys always lose, and that it becomes a ticket for demagoguery, hatred, bigotry, etc. So this has been the introductory lecture to this series. And next Saturday night, God willing, I hope to talk to you about Greek and Roman, how the Jews reacted to them and to their ideas, which is already very well documented. We don't have to rely on legends. And how that affected Jewish life and still affects Jewish life until today.
This concludes this lecture by...
And there you have it, Rabbi Beryl Wine, the very first of our presentations for the 9-day spoken word format. I thank all of you who are tuned in around the world. Rabbi Beryl Wine's lectures are available at 1-800-499-WEIN, 1-800-499-WEIN. It's also rabbiwine.com, rabbiwein.com. This lecture series, which is a recent one given in Jerusalem, is entitled Pagan Europe and Its Impact on the Jews. This lecture, I should say, Pagan Europe and Its Impact on the Jews, and it is part of Rabbi Wine's series on Europe and the Jews. It was part one. We'll get to part two coming up here at JM in the AM.